It was during the last signs of spring that I first laid eyes on her. School was just getting out for the day, and I watched the children getting off the bus I should have been on. Once again, I had skipped classes and stayed home. See, my mother was never very concerned with my whereabouts or lack thereof. My name is Parker Louise Petty, and at that time in my life I spent most of my days sleeping in and eating the most fattening foods I could get my hands on. I was a chubby tomboy with hopes of being someone else, anyone else. "Don't bet on it, hon," someone yelled. As I looked up, I saw the most intriguing, gorgeous woman I'd ever laid eyes on. She was a woman who I would later learn was Miss Ruby. She was making her way out of McFinnigan's, one of the less respectable of our local watering holes. She was very tall, much taller than the women around here. Her hair was red, not that fake kind of orange red you see women sporting, but a deep cherry red with curls that flowed down her narrow back. Son of a bee, don't know a lady when he sees one. What kind of rearing did these people get anyway? Down home a man knows a lady and treats her like one. She reached down her long, curvaceous leg to fix the strap of her high-heeled black pump. She was wearing these funny stockings, kinds that had holes all over them. I always thought women tried to avoid holes in stockings. Our eyes met. She smiled at me and said, "Oh, hey there, darling," in an accent I'd only heard on television. I wanted to look away or say something, but I couldn't. She was the most spectacular sight I'd ever seen around these parts. She strutted by me and headed into Mrs. Williams' store that sold everything from Winston's to American cheese. I suspect that they also sold dirty magazines, but could never quite prove it. Ruby entered the gloomy store. Not enough color in this town, she thought. As the old woman appeared from behind the curtain, Miss Ruby glanced at the lines in her face and quickly refocused her eyes on the candy case. "May I help you?" Mrs. Williams said. "Oh, yes, ma'am. I would just die for one of them cherry suckers. Nothing like a good lolly to bring you back to life, if you know what I mean," Ruby said, smiling. "No, I can't say that I do," Mrs. Williams huffed. It was apparent to Ruby that the people in this Pennsylvania farm town didn't have the southern charm and upbringing she was used to. "Well, anyway, I was wondering if you'd be so kind as to point me in the direction of a cheap motel or something. Not cheap in the sense of decorum, that is. Just price." Mrs. Williams handed her the lollipop in exchange for the nickel and told Ruby about a widow up the road that rented out rooms from time to time. Ruby flashed her a smile, ripped the wrapper off the candy, and stuck it in her mouth with a vigorous suck. Those scenes from the opening of the new novel, Remember Ruby Gentry, by Alexis Phillips. As it happens, this is the theme song, Ruby, from the 1952 movie titled Ruby Gentry. The movie Ruby Gentry will figure in this tale. There will also be other tunes, too. Pink Floyd with Dark Side of the Moon, Neil Young, and even this song by Patsy Cline. It turns out that author Alexis Phillips grew up here in northeastern Pennsylvania, surrounded by music like this, country and gospel, and she actually became a singer-songwriter herself. She spent much of her career working in the publishing industry, and she co-directed the documentary film An Elementary Education. Alexis Phillips paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her first novel, Remember Ruby Gentry, and what music's got to do with it.
I'm always thinking, creating, running scenes through my mind, but it wasn't until I started singing. Well, that's exactly not true. I started singing when I was very young. It wasn't until I started writing songs that I started to put the words in my head on paper.
What was the singing about when you were little?
You know, I wanted to be the next Janis Joplin. I was a blues singer. I was singing Honky Tonk at like 11 years old. And my dad was a big Hank Williams fan and the Ink Spots. And my mom was a big country and Western fan. And so I just absorbed it and loved it. And one of my finest moments, I have to say, happened in fourth grade. I don't know if I ever really went beyond that in terms of success with my singing, but I sang a cappella at the fourth grade talent show at Abington Heights and sang The Rose, and they put me on last, and I was so nervous. I had to try out, and I was so nervous about it. I didn't understand quite why I was last. And I was in front of this gymnasium and got up there and held a fake rose and sang. And the entire auditorium stood up and gave me a standing ovation. And that was the first and last standing ovation I've ever received. But I will cherish it always.
Did you understand what that song was all about?
I did. Yes, I did. I understood, I think, adult life at a very early age, whether that be good or bad, it made me who I am. And I kind of had to roll with the punches in that way. So sure, I understood blues at an early age for sure.
That's almost like a scene from a movie.
You know, there have been people that I've run into from high school and they'll still hearken back and say, fourth grade, The Rose. It is so bizarre, but I'll take it. It was an amazing moment in my life, and I loved it, and it made me want to be a singer.
And what do you sing these days?
You know, I haven't sang a lot these days, but I did live in Boulder for a time. I lived in Boulder for about 9 years. Before that, I was singing here in a local band, and that's when I started writing in my early 20s. And I left to go to New York City to pursue that dream. And that did not quite work out the way I had thought, but it worked out almost even better than I had imagined because I ended up working at this publishing company and got a job at Maxim magazine, and they were only in their second issue. So when I got a job there and I was kind of calling back home to my father saying, oh, I got this job at Maxim, he said, well, I never heard of that magazine. So it was kind of funny, but I was really folk blues based in my writing, in my singing. And when I moved to Boulder, I recorded a CD that was original music and loved that. And then I've been raising kids, though. So kind of my barroom band days are not behind me, I hope, but they have definitely stalled. But that's really where my heart is. And gospel, of course. My grandfather was a Pentecostal minister, and he ran the Italian-American Pentecostal church on Luzerne Avenue back in the 40s. My grandmother never even spoke English and couldn't read a word of it. And even though they had passed, unfortunately, before I was born, I grew up with two Pentecostal uncles. And so the gospel and blues, it's all kind of hand in hand. And I don't know, maybe there's something in me, but it has come out and I can kind of wail at times. And it's very cathartic. I love it.
What about your own writing, then? Do the lyrics come in the music and the lyrics? How does that work in your creative process?
Well, I have to admit, I've never played an instrument, unfortunately. And I used to make the joke, had I been able to accompany myself, my life would have looked much differently. But I just write about what I know, and sometimes I'll call it stick your head in the oven music because I do like to kind of go deep and dark. You know, I love Sylvia Plath and things of that nature, and I'm also a complete optimist and I'm positive, but there's something about that grit that attracts me. So that's kind of what I put on paper.
In reading Remember Ruby Gentry, your ear for dialogue is
really distinctive, and you have a sense of natural flow, and each person has his or her own voice. That's related, I would think, to a sense of musicality in some way.
I would think so, too. Yeah, there is kind of a flow and a cadence to what's happening, and I do think that comes from based on musicality and lyrics and singing and listening to the beat. It's like the beat of life. It's the rhythm of life. So instead of singing this book, I sort of put it down on paper, and it did kind of take a flow. And I love it, and I think it kind of pulled people in that way. You know, people would say to me, and I have to say, releasing it here, which I've just done locally, was a bit of a litmus test, because I thought the characters were interesting and the story was interesting. But when people that I haven't even talked to in years would message me and say, I couldn't put it down, I kept thinking about Ruby and Parker, what's happening to them now, I thought, okay, maybe I'm not crazy. Maybe this could be, maybe this is something. And so thanks to people like you supporting me and giving me exposure, hopefully I'll get there.
When you talked about not writing when you were little, but your imagination was always working, you used the word creating scenes. Did this story arrive in your imagination fully formed? How did it come together?
Well, it was unintended completely. I was living in Boulder with three babies, and I was working freelance for Dennis Publishing that does Maxim and stuff and The Week and those publications. And I just sat down one day and I thought, I'm going to write a short story. And Parker came to me, which of course, most first novels are kind of autobiographical. So I had some things to pull from. So I wrote about Parker and I thought, well, what would happen in this young girl's life during this summer, this girl who is pretty lonely, neglected? What would happen if somebody came in, a girl that was sort of a soul sister and a mentor? What would happen between them? And I thought to bring her from the South that I know nothing about, but I feel like I would love, feel it from my soul.
Well, you probably feel it through some of the music.
I do. Yeah. I'm sure that's where it comes from, for sure. So I just sat down and I wrote, you know, maybe half a chapter. And I thought, okay, maybe I'll go back to this and I'll finish the short story. And honestly, what happened was it just wasn't ending. And so I would go back to it. I love to make the joke. I wrote it between sippy cups, diapers, and play dates because I was never like, hey, I'm a writer. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a novel. That was never my intention. I was just doing it to express myself because I kind of get a little bit antsy when I'm not doing something artistic. And every few months, I would go back and add to it, and I would go back and add to it. And then an idea would come to me. And then all of a sudden, it had this continuity. And these characters were almost writing themselves. So this went on for a good 4 years, probably. It's not a very long novel, but like I said, it wasn't intended to be a novel. And then finally, when I would go back and reread it, because as a responsible writer, you want to make sure everything kind of connects and makes sense, I thought, this could be a novel. These characters can live on a page. So then I committed myself. And then I had it, and I needed to finish it. And I had moved back to Pennsylvania, where I'm from, NEPA. And I had young kids at home. I had four kids at the time. And I said, I need to go to a hotel and lock myself away because I cannot write this ending, as I said, because I was writing this book through everyday chaos. I wasn't setting aside time for myself. I would just grab it when I could get it. And that's what I did. And I spent 2 days in a hotel and by myself. And I wrote it and I cried. And I said goodbye to them. And it was heartbreaking. And then I had it on the shelf for the last couple of years. And life kind of threw me some curveballs. So my dreams, my wants were not really at the forefront. I was just trying to take care of my kids and do what I had to do. And I remember feeling very, you know, torn about it, thinking that Ruby and Parker are sitting there, but I'm doing nothing with them. And so I talked to one of my friends from New York who's also in the publishing field. She's actually in ads, and she read it. I gave her a copy before it was published, of course, and she loved it. And I said, I just don't have the energy to do this, and I don't know if I have the money to publish it. And she said, you can publish this at any time. It's timeless. You don't have to do it today. You don't have to do it this year. And that stuck with me because I didn't give up on the dream. So I had to wait till the dust settled a little bit, and I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. And so this summer I did it.
You're very open about being surprised by the creative process and how it manifested. And it's a wonderful story because I think it gives courage to others who aren't necessarily identifying themselves as a writer. What about the setting in Pennsylvania? Is that important? Could you have set it in some other place, do you think?
I probably could have. I mean, I think the characters could have flowed in any kind of atmosphere that was sort of rural and a little, you know, maybe depressed or what have you. But I wrote about what I know. And I was born here and my parents were born here and my grandparents immigrated from Italy on one side, Ireland on the other. My grandfather was a breaker boy. So I'm very familiar with this. And so I felt it easy to describe. Had I tried to put it in a setting that was alien to me, it probably would have been much more challenging.
What about this remarkable character that you've created in Ruby? It would have been very easy for you to create someone who blew away the boundaries of the proportions that you've established.
I didn't think about it, but now that you're saying it, I guess she could have blown into town and blown out of town, and that would have been the end of it, and she would have been like a whirlwind, and people reading it would have been like, what just happened? But she had to have depth, and she had to have pain, and she had to have yearning, searching for something, because that's what connected her and Parker. So her being a mentor, even though, you know, Parker's 14 and she's in her 20s, they really fed each other because there are these women who are struggling to find themselves, and they help each other and they support each other. So I think if I made Ruby too overbearing, it wouldn't have played well. And honestly, it just wouldn't have felt sincere to me.
Have you had a mentor who has been very important to you in your own life?
Well, to be honest with you, I sort of based Ruby in certain ways in her support for Parker and her sort of saving Parker in some moments based on my sister, who's 11 years older than me, who passed away 9 years ago unexpectedly. Her name was Rebecca Phillips Harper, and she was always sort of my savior, and she was beautiful. And so even though she and Ruby are vastly different in so many ways, the core of the support and the love really was driven by her.
You explain how we get Ruby's name, and you may not want to tell because it would be lovely if listeners came upon it, but names are important to you.
Names are very important to me. I was singing with a band here before I went to New York City, and we had a name, and we thought maybe we would go on the road. And so it turned out the name was taken by this band, you know, from a really long time ago, but still it was a copyright issue, and we thought, okay, and we had original music. So I said, what if we name the band Ruby Gentry? For some reason, I don't know why, this name always stuck with me. So that did not go over well. It was a male band except for me. So they were like, no. And then the band fell apart, of course. And I moved to New York City and I was dating someone at the time. And I said, you know, there's something about this name Ruby Gentry that is haunting me. And he looked it up and he said, that was a movie. So I thought, thanks, Dream Crusher. And so then I just went about my business. But when I wrote this, I thought, I'm not letting this character go because of a movie. And then I watched the movie after I was halfway through the novel. And I watched it and I thought, this is seamless. And so I created the scene between Ruby and Parker where they discuss their names. And if anybody wants to watch Ruby Gentry, it's a beautiful old movie with Jennifer Jones, Charlton Heston. And so it is a cautionary tale. And I had her mother, who was very important to Ruby, say to her, remember Ruby Gentry. It was kind of a warning. So then it all really came together then. And when I wrote that scene, I kind of got chills and I was more than thrilled that this name had haunted me because it ended up making sense in this story. So I couldn't have planned it better.
What about the details such as the red hair or people's clothing? In addition to dialogue and what people say about themselves, how do you evoke character in this?
I think I just write what I see in my head. I don't know how to explain it. I'm not a very orchestrated writer. I sometimes came back to this, and listen, this is not the great American novel, but I think it's a worthy piece of work. And I wouldn't be sitting here if I didn't wholeheartedly believe that. So sometimes I would come back to it and I would think, did I write that? Sometimes I felt like it wrote itself, but everything about, you know, and it might be very obvious, but I thought, well, of course Ruby's going to be a gorgeous redhead. And why shouldn't she be? And she's from the South. So that played. And then it wasn't a far leap to think, okay, Parker's this a little bit overweight, insecure 13-year-old because, hey, I mean, I could relate to that. So I was just creating these characters and putting those kinds of details about what they looked like, what they wore. It just was in my head. It just came. I just saw them. I saw them. I didn't really think about it. I just saw them.
When you went into the hotel, what was that writing experience like? Did that just come to you? Were you wrestling with tying up ends? Did you know where you were going, but you just had to execute it?
I knew where it was going. And yes, I had to pay respect to where it was going. That's why I was serious about it and took the time to actually leave home for a couple of days, because I knew it deserved my care. And yes, I knew where it was going, but that did not make it easier to write, I have to say.
We talked about your music and you talked about how you like the grit and the blues. It's pain and life is hard and suffering and people are losing people and all of those things, the subjects of the blues. Is there any sense that you are a writer with courage because you've been to those places, not only in your own life, perhaps, and in the music? Do you know those emotions?
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to say, unfortunately, yes. But honestly, it just kind of makes me who I am, for better or for worse. I mean, the world is on fire right now, right? So everybody has their own personal view. And people feel isolated and they have their own pain that they don't think other people understand. But obviously, it's a very universal thing. So I'm not afraid to put it out there because I know I'm not the only one. Do I feel vulnerable sometimes? Did I feel vulnerable after some people read this book and said, hey, did that really happen? Was your life like that? That is a strange place to be in, because obviously it's fiction, so not everything is completely factual, but also there is a lot of truth throughout, which I think, you know, most works have, whether it's a blues song or what have you. So it's a place of courage, a place of vulnerability, but I think mainly it's a place of allowing other people to feel they belong.
Isn't it that connection that gives us that sense that we can stand the pain or the suffering in life because it's shared on some level.
I would hope so. And I think the people I admire the most are the people who will put it out there. The people who say, listen, I've been through a lot, or maybe I haven't, but I see your pain. I'm not going to judge you for it. I'm not going to judge those experiences. I mean, we got way too much of that going on right now where people are judging others for whatever. And we're all just, I would hope, thinking, trying to live our best life. So, you know, I'm putting this out there. I'm putting myself out there in some way, and I'm not afraid to do it.
What about the friends or people who have contacted you and said, well, I'm wondering about Parker and I'm wondering about Ruby?
Well, I have to say that response, and it really has been completely targeted response, that what happens to them. It is a sequel. And I was kind of shocked by that. People were saying they lingered with me and I want to know what happens to Ruby and I want to know what happens to Parker. And I think I have that story in me. I have not started writing it yet. You know, I have put money and time into self-publishing and trying to promote. It's not the easiest thing to do as a single mother. This is my dream and I'm going all in. So I can start writing that now. I think I would feel less fearful if maybe I got a publishing deal that somebody could be like, hey, you can pay the bills and you can start writing this next. You know, when I have three kids at home, I think, do I really have the luxury of doing this? So that's yet to be seen. I mean, I'm not going to stop fighting for it, but I wanted to say come back down to reality. But honestly, reality is just kind of not that fun. So I think maybe I'll start it regardless. But that's my dream. I mean, I'm doing this for my kids as much as me. And I'm really doing it for Ruby and Parker. I mean, I love them. I love them.
Author Alexis Phillips, native of northeastern Pennsylvania, speaking with us about her first novel, Remember Ruby Gentry. For more information, you can check the website, rememberrubygentry.com, rememberrubygentry.com. Alexis Phillips, her last name is spelled Phillips. It's Alexis Phillips. The novel is Remember Ruby Gentry, and you can find out more information online and read more, rememberrubygentry.com. RememberRubyGentry.com.